Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How long has it been since you had time on your hands? The frenetic pace of 21st century life is ironically tied to our obsessive pursuits of speed and efficiency that at one point seemed to promise more time for leisure and reflectiveness as technology offered ways to travel, communicate, and earn money fast. In fact, we are using up precious resources that cannot be replenished, and our pursuit of instant profits, up-to-the-minute clothes and gadgets, and constantly updated information has left many people feel as if they are falling behind. Mark C. Taylor joins us to talk about this. He is professor and chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University and author of the new book Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. Mark, welcome to Think.
Delighted to be here.
Early in the book, you share a passage from your father's diary that he kept as a teenager in 1922. Can you talk about what struck you about that and how different his life might be from that of a teenager today?
Yes, my father was born in 1907 near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Spent his life on a farm, which probably was not that different from what farm life had been like 100 years earlier. Got up at 4 in the morning, tended the livestock, walked 3 miles to a one-room schoolhouse, walked home to deal with the same animals at night. I have his report cards, and each March his grades fell off a cliff because they pulled him out of school to plow the fields behind a horse-drawn and then a mule-drawn plow. He lived until he was 92, and we used to have conversations during the last years of his life about who would have seen more greater change in his life, him or me. And he was persuaded at the time that there was no way the change could be as great in my life as his, having gone from no electricity and no plumbing and no cars to a man on the moon, he used to say. Hmm. And for a while I was persuaded, but that was before the Internet revolution, the fall of the Soviet Union and the like. And his life, I think, in fact, I will now see more change than he did because life is just accelerated extraordinarily. Many of the trends that now are driving our lives started back in the 19th century. But he was a teacher his whole life, and often marveled at how different his life was from his students. Though I also found tucked away in the back of this diary, which was a remarkable document. He was 15 years old at the time. The examinations he had in the spring of 1922 in this small country high school by that point. I teach at an Ivy League school, and I would venture that 70% of the students at Columbia could not pass those tests that he had in that small little schoolhouse.
Because there was time to focus on deep thinking?
Part of it was the range. I think it was everything from physiology to geography to the normal arithmetic and writing and the like. But I think part of it is, as you suggest, there was a certain greater depth. Our students, I mean, the technology has completely transformed young people's lives in ways they don't read and they don't write as they once did. It's different. I think there's some ways in which it's better. There are many ways in which it's worse. Students have very great difficulty writing long arguments and papers well now. Everything's quick. Memory has been outsourced to machines. You ask them a question, the first thing they do is to Google it. Hmm. They never go to a library to do their research. I always try to tell them they should go to the library because the book they're looking for, the book they need is next to the book they're looking for.
Yeah.
They don't understand the way in which search engines orchestrate knowledge, structure knowledge in ways that we don't fully detect. So there are a lot of problems with education from the from pre-K all the way through doctoral students in my judgment.
all the conveniences available to us in everyday life somehow leave us with the sense that we have less control over our time. How is it possible that when we have a machine to wash our clothes and to wash our dishes and we can, you know, drive to work at 70 miles an hour, that we feel like we have less free time than ever?
I think that's one of the paradoxes, especially with electronic, and not just electronic, but as you suggest, automobiles, washing machines, and the like. But with all the electronic devices, these devices were supposed to save time, but they don't. They end up preoccupying us. There are multiple reasons for that, I think. I think that there have been unintended consequences of these technologies. As you've suggested, the technologies that were supposed to liberate us and save us time now enchain us and cost us time. We feel that if we're not connected 24/7, 365, we're not very important. Part of that has been a change in the social status of leisure. In earlier years, social status was measured by how little you work. Now it's often measured by how much you work. In 1971, President Nixon appointed a commission to study what would happen in 20 years when technology was going to create a condition where people were only working 20 hours a week, and what a leisure society was going to do. All that's gone. I asked my students, it's an undergraduate class, last week, how many of them sleep with their iPhone by their bed? And every single student raised his or her hand.
You also point out the fact that there are people who don't take all of the vacation time that they've earned.
Correct.
At work. And there's no one on the planet, I don't think, who says, I don't actually need this many paychecks, so I'm not going to cash a couple of this year. Mm-hmm. Why is it that we value money in a way that we don't value time?
It's a very, very good question. I frame the book in terms of precisely that question. The fundamental question we face is your time or your money. The only two things people never think they have enough of is time or money. And the trade-off for many is always money over time. I sometimes tell my students, and I've often told and always tell my children, that when you face an important decision, try to imagine what that decision will look like as you look back on it at the end of your life. I don't know many people who would say, my biggest regret was that I didn't work another week. I think the reason for some of this is what I call trickle-down anxiety. I don't believe in trickle-down economics, but I do believe in trickle-down anxiety. We've created a society which, for many reasons, is predicated upon risk and anxiety. And one of the reasons people don't take their vacation, I think, is because they're afraid about losing their job, or they're afraid that it will be discovered that they're not as essential as they can. At the same time, our politicians ridicule Europeans and especially the French for taking 6-week vacations. It's a paradox.
And we measure well-being very much in this society by GDP and not by anything else.
Totally. And that's a recent development. I was surprised to discover this, that it's only since the Second World War that economic well-being has been measured by GDP. So I think that what happens is human well-being is measured by economic well-being. Economic well-being is then measured by GDP. And during the Cold War, the economic debate was whether communism or capitalism delivered more consumer goods faster. Capitalism appeared to have won that debate. But there's a cost. When we've created an economic system predicated upon growth, and part of the issue with speed is related to this economy of growth in certain ways. If markets must grow, there are only three ways in which that can occur. One is spatial. You open another branch in another city or country. One is differential. You create a different product. The average American supermarket has 48,000 different products. The iPhone had not been introduced when Obama was elected. There's been a new iPhone each year during his term. So we have expanding the market. And the third, and I think most relevant way to expand the market is to accelerate the product cycle so that you increase the product churn. There's all this talk about innovation, but innovation is really just another way to implement creative destruction as a way of expanding the market by accelerating, whether it's fast fashion, whether it's fast food, or whether it's high speed, high volume trading in financial markets.
And all of that stuff that we are consuming due to planned obsolescence ends up requiring resources that don't necessarily regenerate.
That's absolutely right. I would say there are two factors. One, it creates an enormous amount of waste. Fast fashion industry, for instance, Zara's. Some of you may know about Zara. Why were fashion seasons introduced? It goes back to the introduction of mass production. The first thing that mass production, this is in the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, the first thing that mass production had to produce was mass consumption. And for mass consumption, there had to be constant purchasing. When everybody had a refrigerator or a car, the problem became, how do you create the desire for another? You create fashion seasons or annual car models. Annual car models were only introduced in 1960. Prior to that, you had every 3 years. The average time an American keeps a car now is about 3.5 years. You turn over the product cycle. Fast fashion produces, in Zara's, they turn over the inventory every 3 weeks. But that creates a huge amount of waste. We also generate a huge amount of digital waste, which is very, very toxic. Most of that is shipped to China, where it's recycled, but has created huge amounts of pollution. The other area where this occurs is in the energy requirements for all of this. We are on the edge of catastrophic climate change. That's not speculation. It's fact. We don't know when that's going to occur, but it is going to occur. And the constant commitment to growth and the constant use, I hesitate to say this, program in Dallas of fossil fuels is unsustainable. We have to find ways to deal with these problems because climate change and financial bubbles work in the same way. There's gradual change until you reach what they call the tipping point, and then there's seismic catastrophic change.
Let's jump back in time a little bit. What does the Protestant Reformation have to do with the way we value speed today?
It's a very good question. I believe that modernity, and that's an important point to see, that the preoccupation with speed is a modern invention. It's tied to modernism and to modernity in ways we can talk about. But modernity, I believe, begins in many ways with Martin Luther's Reformation. Two primary things that I'll first. First of all, what Luther does vis-a-vis the Catholic Church. In the Catholic Church, during the High Middle Ages, salvation came by participation in the Church Universal as it was mediated by a hierarchical church. So the Catholic Church was hierarchical and centralized. The only way in which you could be saved was to participate in that church through the sacraments. They were the keys to the afterlife. Luther comes along and changes that whole system. What he does is to privatize, deregulate, and decentralize religion. Right? And in business jargon, what he does is to disintermediate the church. He takes out the middleman.
Hmm.
Those three principles eventually are enacted in today's neoliberal economics of Milton Friedman. And the way you get from there here to there, if you cite the image of the invisible hand, the one everybody associates that with is Adam Smith. But it wasn't Smith who first used that image. It was John Calvin.
Let me jump in right there. I want to take a break so we can get the rest of this. My guest is Mark C. Taylor. We're talking about his book, Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mark C. Taylor, who is professor and chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University. His new book is called Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Mark, before the break, you were saying that some of the outcomes that people, long-term outcomes that people attribute to Adam Smith, in fact, are attributable to John Calvin instead.
Correct. As I was saying, the first person to use the image of the invisible hand, which is associated with Adam Smith's interpretation of the market, was John Calvin, who used the invisible image of the invisible hand to talk about God's providential activity. So God, through his providential activity, weaves good out of human sin. What Smith does, in effect, is to internalize that principle of governance and make it the invisible hand of the market. For Smith, the market weaves common good out of individual selfishness in that way. By the time we get to the market, what we might call the market fundamentalism of Milton Friedman, the market in effect becomes God. That is to say, the market is omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient. Mm-hmm. And human beings, just as sinful human beings for Calvin, can only mess things up by intervening. So human beings with limited knowledge can only mess up the machinations of the market by their intervention. So there's a theological genealogy to the modern notion of the market that governs so much of economic theory and political policy these days.
How did speed become synonymous with success in markets?
It's related to the issue of growth, but again, all of this doesn't just begin with the internet. You have to go back to the Industrial Revolution, and I think when speed really took off was in the 1840s and 1850s with the invention of the telephone, telegraph, and stock ticker. Where speed really took off was when the message was decoupled from the physical means of conveyance. That is to say, prior to the invention of the telegraph, telephone, and stock ticker, the message could only travel as fast as a human, a horse, a train, a ship. There's a relationship between trains and all of this because the telegraph and telephone lines were laid along the railroad tracks. But as industrialization began to take place, the efficiency of production came to be valued very, very highly. So when Frederick Winslow Taylor in 1911 developed his scientific principles of management, that was all predicated upon literally going into the factory with a stopwatch and measuring the time that it took workers to do each phase of their process to try to create the most efficient, which was the fastest means of production as a way of means of fulfilling their job, which was a way of increasing the speed of production. So that same principle of market expansion by speed only increases in today's high-speed markets.
Did people, Mark, embrace those ideas uncritically at the time, like when Taylor came along and said, I can help you shave 12% off the amount of time it takes to do this or that? Or were people concerned even then that we might be entering a period at which things started to grow beyond our control?
It was both. The impact of these technologies on people at the time was significant because we must also remember that we also had the emergence of photography and cinema. Cinema was very, very important. It's really interesting to read some of the accounts of people who were first traveling on railroad trains because they were just overwhelmed and completely disoriented by the speed of the train. And when you read those descriptions, they're very similar in certain ways to descriptions that you read of children or adolescents who have attention deficit disorder. So there's a huge psychological impact of all of these technologies, first industrial, and it just keeps getting faster and faster and faster. That's part of the issue with our kids now. I mean, the trickle-down anxiety isn't just from bosses to workers, but it's from parents to children. Our kids are taking Ritalin, right, which is speed, either to help them concentrate, or my students tell me that a remarkable number of college students take Ritalin as a way of trying to help them concentrate when they're trying to produce papers and exams. So the deleterious effects of speed already began in the 19th century and have only increased in the course of the 20th century.
Are their papers any better because they're taking this drug if they don't need it?
They're worse. They're worse. They can't write. The students write and read a lot, but they don't write and read sustained works. I taught a course last spring in which it was called Literature, Technology, and Religion. It concentrated on four big novels. Not a single student, again, this is juniors and seniors at Columbia, not a single student in that course had read a novel of 400 pages.
Are you serious?
They don't read long works.
Wow.
Yeah. Right.
The first time I saw someone respond on the internet that the initials TLDNR, that stands for too long, did not read. People won't even read articles that are long.
Correct. One of the most important courses I ever had was as a graduate student at Harvard, in which it was a German professor teaching a course on Hegel, a German philosopher, mm-hmm. who's at the root of everything I work on. We spent the entire semester on 14 pages of Hegel's Science of Logic. And probably 90% of what I've written and taught since then has grown out of that 14 pages.
So starting after World War II, we had this thing, niche marketing. How did that evolve into what we have today in the form of mass customization?
So I said a minute ago that the first thing that mass production had to produce was mass consumption. Mm. That led to mass advertising. It led to TV networks, national publications. You know, national networks only emerged in the 1930s and 1940s, where we had three national networks and the like. Again, what begins to happen is that what the technology now enables us to do is to move from mass marketing to, as you suggest, mass customization, in which, and we've seen this in many ways, in which they're using these technologies as a way of gathering information and data that they then use to target us for products and the like. There's been a great deal of understandable and justifiable criticism of the National Security, the NSA, for gathering data. There has been an insufficient awareness of and criticism of all these companies gathering massive, massive, massive amounts of data in order to know in order to try to program our buying. And again, it's a way of trying to expand the market. So one of the contradictions is that these technologies that were supposed to connect us are now dividing us. That is to say, Marshall McLuhan famously said, this is going to create a global village. It does. They do connect us. But what begins to happen is everything gets customized. So it's not only this targeting, but everybody has their own individual news feed. We no longer have a national newspaper, right? Everybody gets his or her. Everybody watches his or her own TV station. So we end up in bubbles. At one point, I thought within education that these technologies were going to break down all the silos that people are in and create interconnections. In fact, in some ways, it's reinforced the silos. And those very methods that are used for advertising and mass customization have been carried over into the political realm and are being used to market politicians through these various technologies. So there are many reasons for the political divisiveness that we have in this country. But paradoxically, one of the reasons for all of this divisiveness is the result of the very technologies that were supposed to connect us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bill in Fort Worth. Hello, Bill.
Hello. I have three comments. Number one, I think your guest has identified a great issue in our society. I applaud your station for putting him on. Number two, I'm 72 years old, and I started off in industrial engineering in the early 60s, and I'm familiar with Frederick Taylor and Gil Brass and production engineering. My original conception was that mass production would help people improve their lives and in the process have more time for human values, and that rapidly proved not to be true. which leads me to my third point. If I were to have to put one reason, and it's never one, it's always a multifactorial etiology, for one reason for our problems, it would be values. There seems to be an immoral inversion from my perspective. We, time and time again throughout society, have seen in private and public sector and individuals that money and materiality trump human values, health, public health. You know, we're so interested in money and buying things that we've created this lifestyle that's driving us crazy mentally, emotionally, physically. We're living longer, but we're in such bad shape.
What do you think about all that, Mark?
Thank you, Bill. I agree. Let me try to take 3 points that you make. First, industrialization as leading to improvement of life. Henry Ford famously said that when he introduced the assembly line, that what he was working for was 8 hours of work, 8 hours of leisure, 8 hours of sleep. Now that sounds like a quaint dream of the past. It's not turned out that way at all. In terms of I'll come back to the value point because that's important. In terms of the last point you make, I think that's also correct. I asked I use my students as a sounding board for some of this. I asked them whether they, because all of them have iPhone 6, right? I'm coming to you from Manhattan. A month or so ago, I was over on the east side of Manhattan by the Apple Store. There was a line outside the Apple Store literally of 600 people.
Wow.
Waiting to get the iPhone 6. I asked them, will the iPhone 6 make your life any better? And the answer is, for the most part, I think probably no. Marginally a better camera, but it doesn't really make your life any better. I completely agree with the issue of values. I think that one of the problems is that the system that we have created, the very values that have made this system, this form of capitalism, successful, now threaten it in certain ways. The problems of individualism, of competition, of utility, and of efficiency, of choice for choice's sake, of growth and for speed. Those are now turning counterproductive. And the very values that have been repressed, a sense of community, of cooperation, of patience, of reflection, of deliberation, and of sustainability, are now those that we need in this way. One of the things that's been insufficiently understood, it seems to me, is with all the talk about the social consequences of the wealth gap, what hasn't been adequately understood is that wealth gap is really a speed gap.
Hmm.
We have two economies that are working at two different speeds. We have the real economy, which in previous forms of capitalism, industrialism, consumer capitalism, wealth was generated by selling labor or stuff. In this form of capitalism, wealth is generated by trading virtual assets that are really nothing but signs. And those virtual assets, we've heard them all, mortgage, derivatives, all that kind of stuff, they scale at a rate much faster than real assets. So in your segue to this show, I was talking about the stock market being approaching yet another record high day after day after day, while the real economy is in the tank. Why? Because this virtual economy, through high-speed, high-volume trading, has been completely decoupled from the real economy. They have nothing to do with each other. So the social consequences of that are huge, right? And again, it's a question of value. And it's not even the 0.1%. It's the 0.01% where this inequity is accelerating.
And, of course, if we can, get rich quick in high finance because of the competitive advantages of a millisecond here or there, we can get poor quick just as fast, right?
Exactly. You may have heard of this, but the speed has reached such a limit that financial firms in Dallas cannot trade on New York financial markets because of the nanoseconds required to transmit buy or sell orders from Dallas to New York. When the New York Stock Exchange went completely digital, which is very recently, they put their servers out in Mahwah, New Jersey. And right next to the servers of the market, they created a huge warehouse as big as 3 football fields, where financial firms now put their servers to be physically as close to the market as they can be to cut down on the nanosecond transmission. 70% of the trades now being done are done in nanoseconds on these high speed with no human intervention. It's an unsustainable system.
What happens to people in occupations that are not technologically enabled and that cannot be scaled up in such a way as to compete at this rate of speed?
I think they're going to suffer. I mean, when I was in college in the 60s and 70s, the people, mostly guys, who were going to make a lot of money were doctors. Not anymore, and it's not Obamacare. Being a doctor or being a teacher doesn't scale. A doctor can see so many students an hour. A teacher can only teach so many students in a classroom. One of the reasons for the obsession with online education now, which I have tried to do. I started a company in 1998 to try to do this. But my goal was to try to save students money. Schools now see online education as a way of trying to generate more revenue by expanding student body without increasing the size of the campus. But other than that, there is no way to create jobs that are going to keep up with the speed of these new industries. And in addition to that, these new industries that everybody hears about are not job generators. Mark Zuckerberg has claimed, and it's what, $100 billion company or whatever it is now, it's what it was when it's IPO.
Facebook.
He has claimed that the total number of people he ever imagines working for Facebook is 5,000.
Wow.
That's not many jobs. If you had General Motors, and even as as the auto industry improves, robots are cutting way, way back. I mean, Detroit may be back, but it's doing it with far fewer people. So all the talk about creating more jobs, it's a systemic problem, and it has to be looked at systemically.
We're speaking with Mark C. Taylor. He's professor and chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University and author of the new book, Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mark C. Taylor, who is chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University and author of Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Mark, if in the modern world we have access, unlimited access to information instantaneously, but silos are not breaking down so that people know, they're able to go ever deeper in a very, very narrow field.
And more about less and less.
Right. What happens to creativity that really requires a lot of mixing it up and a lot of messy interactions between different fields?
I couldn't agree more. I think creativity occurs by bringing together what is usually held apart. And one of the problems with our educational system and with higher education in particular is that since the 1970s, as a result of the deterioration of the job market within the academy, there's been a movement toward hyper-specialization and hyper-professionalization within the university. So in my department, for example, is the Department of Religion at Columbia University. We have 12 or 13 full-time people in the department, and we have 8 subfields, each of which is further divided. So, for example, Buddhist studies is one of our good subfields, but that's for the one of the 8 subfields. But that's further divided into Japanese, Chinese, Korean, and Tibetan Buddhism. So it's more and more about less and less. The difficulty is not just that people don't connect the dots, but they don't know what the dots are to connect. Hmm. So, for instance, to understand our current situation with the speed, we have to understand, I think, how it emerged. We've been talking about that out of the 19th century, all the way back to the Protestant Reformation, to see how religion influences economics, which influences religion. We have to see how art, I mean, modern art is all about the new. Make it new. That's Ezra Pound's definition for what modernity is. That is simply a version of Joseph Schumpeter's planned obsolescence, which is then transferred into Clayton Christensen's disruptive innovation. You have to understand the interconnection of all of these things. And we have to understand the interconnection of the economic system with our ecological system. We haven't talked about that, but the ecological system, what we're doing is unsustainable ecologically. So the problem is, at one level, that we have to restructure education as well, because education is highly siloed, and it's a self-reinforcing system, right? That experts pass judgment on experts, and even very, very smart people know very little about what's outside their silo.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go now to Doug in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Hello, Dr. Taylor.
Hello,
a comment and a quick question. I got my MBA in 1993. It's neither here nor there, but all of my courses that dealt with portfolio theory and efficient frontiers, all of that, dealt around the concept of the so-called rational man. And my question is, to what, and I have no professors, by the way, that ever talked about the so-called rational man having perfect information. In other words, imperfect decisions, it wasn't whether they're perfect or not, it's to the extent to which they were imperfect. So since 1993, how is that gap closed? I would imagine we haven't gotten to perfectibility of perfect information, but to what extent in the last 21 years has that gap closed where more perfect information is available? The second question is
well, let me jump in there, because we're kind of running out of time. So if you let's have Mark respond to that.
So basically what has happened since the 1980s and 1990s is, again, with it was only in the 1980s that computers were introduced to the trading floor. The real revolution didn't come with computers; it came with networking, linking them up. That's what created the new infrastructure, both for trading, but also then for information. So we have increased information that is a function of these networks. So there is a greater distribution of information, for sure. I develop in the book what I call the inefficient market hypothesis, because part of the problem is that in modernity, rationality gets associated with economic choices. I mean, that's usually what we mean when somebody is acting rationally. But of course, human beings in all of their capacities are not simply rational. They're driven by all other kinds of forces and the like. So even though there's a greater, I mean, there are ways, I don't have time to go into it now, but there are ways in which the increased distribution of information has made markets less efficient, because because the margins decrease, the price differentials decrease, and therefore the volume has to increase. There are two ways to make money: a lot of money on a few bets or a little money on a lot of bets. When everybody has equal information, there's the price differentials are less, so they have to trade more, which means there's greater possibility of volatility. In addition to that, the only way in which a form of capitalism we've created can thrive is if people borrow and either spend or invest money they don't have for stuff they don't need. And that generates huge inefficiencies and excess. So, I mean, and furthermore, the other basis for modern economic theory is equilibrium. These systems are what we call positive feedback systems. They're not equilibrium systems. They move toward disequilibrium and disruption. So the very premises of rationality, of efficiency, of equal information, and of equilibrium all seem to me to be questionable.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Zach on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a sort of a smartphone holdout. I still have an old-school flip phone, but my wife has an iPhone, and so occasionally I've gotten used to using it and all the convenience it brings with it. And I've just noticed sort of, if I'm out by myself, a little bit of dissatisfaction whenever I am wanting a certain piece of information, and I, of course, can't find it because I have a flip phone. You know, if I'm shopping on, where's another store nearby me, or how late is this thing open, or something like that. And it's just very strange. 5 or 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been any sort of issue. It would have been sort of par for the course. But now that I know there's another option, I at times find myself maybe dissatisfied with something I would have been perfectly content with 5 or 10 years ago.
You're absolutely right. The first thing that speed produces is a sense of slowness. The horse didn't seem slow until there was the car, right? And faster, I mean, the argument is faster is always better. But is it? Because there's a cost to speed. You're absolutely right. I mean, we all know how frustrated we get when there's a delay in calling something up. But in order to have the speed of response on in these systems, all of these companies, you have massive server farms that where they're only using about 10% of the capacity. The rest of the 90% is they're idling. Wait, it, just in case there's any kind of delay, because they know if there's a delay, they're going to lose their customers, and all of that takes a huge amount of energy. So this, you know, this virtual cyber immaterial economy rests upon real material resources, precious metals, fossil fuels, and the like. The sense of slowness is created by speed.
What kind of strain does that sense of slowness, that lack of time, put on just ordinary human relationships?
I think at one level or another, we all know we're running too fast. And the faster we run, the more behind we get. You see it not only in adults, but with children and young people. It puts enormous strain on all of us. But we're afraid to take time out. We're afraid to slow down. But again, the problems we face take time and reflection to address. I don't think we can solve the problems by simply stopping and smelling the roses, so that's not unimportant. They're systemic, but they do take time to think about and to reflect and just to enjoy. I mean, again, leisure is something that used to be valued. I don't hear it valued all that much anymore.
It's treated, the desire for leisure is treated a little bit like a weakness.
Totally. Absolutely. I mean, and let's go back to what I was saying about Europe and France. When you hear people talking about the problems with Europe and they usually mean France, what is it? That they take 6 week vacation? Life in France and Italy isn't half bad. It's a different pace, you know, but somehow we have been convinced, we have been programmed, and that's what it is. It's a programming that speed, the faster, the better. And there's a strong Puritanism to this, that, as you suggest, that taking time out, taking time off, taking leisure is a problem. There was an article in the Times this weekend about the prejudice against fathers who take parental leave to be with their children. They lose. I've seen that up close. Someone I know closely took 2 days off when his son was born, came back to the law firm the next week, and was frozen out by the senior partner for 2 months because he took an extra day for his son.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Arvin on the line in Dallas. Hi, Arvin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a fascinating topic, and I'd like to go back to the point where you mentioned going to the library, and it's always the book you need is next to the book that you want. It reminds me that because of this, the speed at which the task list that we actually make up for a day comes so fast with the technology that we always, it's the next thing that we were worried about, not the thing that we have. And in fact, in terms of, if I have to think in terms of how we perceive the time, I think it has been changed. The notion of time has been changed. Right now, it's always about the next thing, and it's never going along with the time. It is either going against with the time or racing with the time. But it's always rarely been just going with the flow and enjoying a minute as a 60 seconds.
What do you think, Mark?
I agree. I mean, I would say that the preoccupation with speed leads to concern about the future, that leads us to dismiss the significance of the present. I would also say the preoccupation with the future leads to disregard for the past. In my career, I've spent my life studying major, very difficult philosophers and writers from the 19th century. And yet when I study them, I find lessons that help me understand what's going on today. The way you learn is to apprentice yourself to great minds, and that takes time. It takes discipline. You have to learn how to I love the name of your show, Think. Thinking's rare. Thinking is rare in today's world. We don't take time to think and to reflect. But it's in thinking with great minds who might come from a very, very different world, teach you how to think in your own way about your own time and to take the time, to allow the time to think. It's very interesting to look at the rhetoric of time. It's all economic, to spend time, to save time, to take time. In a certain way, time isn't ours to take.
Right, time and we all end up with none of it at the end, right?
That's right. That's right. That's what I say. The only thing you don't have enough of is time or money. And if you have the choice, time, your time or your money, right? We may choose money over time, but at the end of the day, given that choice, my guess is most of us would take time over money.
So, Mark, you're not a Luddite. Talk about what is required to put all of this into context so that we can continue to embrace speed where it truly serves us and learn to slow things down for things that really deserve our time and our close attention.
Well, one of the additional paradoxes with all of this is that we can't simply address the problem of speed slowly. Because in some ways, I think time is running out, especially with respect to climate and the like. I mean, we have to understand that the world is limited. I mean, in the title Speed Limits, I intend limits to be both a noun and a verb. Hmm. Speed actually limits us in certain ways. Tom Friedman has made a reputation with his notion that the world is flat. We have to be careful about the metaphors that we use because they shape the world we're in. The world isn't flat. It suggests infinite expandability. The world is metaphorically and literally round, right? Which means that there are limits and there's constraint. The question of the redistribution of wealth and resources, it's not a choice. Either we're going to figure out how to redistribute the resources and wealth, or we're going to destroy the planet. So, but these problems are not just national, they're global, they're international. They will require careful thought, reflection, deliberation, and political and social action and the like. And in the midst of all of this, time's short.
Mark C. Taylor is professor and chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University. His new book is called Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. Mark, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for giving us this time.
Thank you so much for allowing me this time.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.